From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Growing up, Mike Rose bluffed and cheated his way through school, but along the way his attitudes changed, and he came to value then love books. Now Mike Rose helps other students get out of the educational underclass. On this edition of Fresh Air, Rose talks about his life as student and teacher, the subject of his new book, Lives on the Boundary. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two other new books about education in America. We talk with writer Ursula Le Guin. Her science fiction and fantasy novels explore issues related to gender and social responsibility. And jazz pianist Kenny Barron is featured in our weekly performance spot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In his new book, Lives on the Boundary, Mike Rose writes, I've worked for 20 years with children and adults deemed slow or remedial or underprepared. And at one time in my own educational life, I was so labeled, but I was lucky. I managed to get redefined. The people I've tutored and taught and the people whose lives I've studied, working-class children, poorly educated Vietnam veterans, underprepared college students, adults in a literacy program, they, for the most part, hadn't been so fortunate. They lived for many of their years in an educational underclass. Rose's new book is about teaching students from that educational underclass and about his own student days in that underclass. Rose is the Associate Director of Writing Programs at UCLA, and he's received awards from the National Academy of Education, the McDonnell Foundation, and the National Council of Teachers of English. Mike Rose grew up in a working-class Italian family in South L.A. In high school, he was mistakenly placed in the vocational track, which he describes as a euphemism for the bottom level. Here's how the mistake was made.
When students enter high school, as you know, they're given a series of tests. Those tests are a bit different now, but they always contain IQ tests. And the IQ test I took was confused with that of another student with my same last name. And so I was placed in the vocational track and remained there for a couple of years. What's interesting to me about that, Terry, is that it's not that a mistake was made with one kid in one school, but it shows how easily mistakes can be made, and it shows how if you are a student like I was from a working-class family whose parents didn't know much about what schooling was supposed to be, that there would really be no checks or balances to protect students from these sorts of problems. I mean, my mother went to the seventh grade. My father had a couple years of elementary school in Italy. And so as far as they knew, there was nothing unusual with this particular placement. And since I had no, you know, quadrants to be able to understand what was going on with me, well, then I saw nothing amiss about it either.
You think that the vocational track was a dead end, but nobody in your family realized it at the time.
That's right. And this sort of problem continues, of course, with people from the working class, immigrant families, they don't necessarily have the body of experience you'd need to know that something was dramatically wrong.
Well, looking back, do you think that your self-image or your ability to learn was affected by the lower expectations people had of you once you were in the vocational track?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I can tell you that I managed to live down to the expectations of the vocational track quite well. I was, in retrospect, I'm proud of myself, the degree to which I just sort of fit in, and you do lower your expectations of yourself. You are not challenged particularly. You know that in some way you're getting a very different curriculum from other kids, and that affects you. The school treats you in a certain way, and other students treat you in a certain way, and all of this just works its way into your marrow. Now, I was blessed. An extremely unusual thing happened to me, and I was released from that track, but that is not what happens to most kids who are placed in tracks like that.
Yeah, one teacher discovered the error
right.
in your records and then put
right.
you back on a college track.
Right, that's right. Which then, of course, had its own problems. I mean, by then, I was a horrible student. I had no background worth speaking of in mathematics or the sciences. I had developed a sloppy way of dealing with school. I sort of, intellectually toyed with my food, and it was a difficult transition and one that I really wasn't ready for.
Did you come up with ways of faking it so that nobody would notice that you didn't understand what was happening in class?
Yeah, I think a lot of students come up with ways of faking it. You can look more alert than you are. You figure out ways of cheating. I mean, I used to develop all sorts of little scrolls that had chemistry formulas on them that we managed to conceal. There's all sorts of ways that either legally or illegally you try to seem like you're a little bit more in control than you are. The sad thing, though, is that, you know, Terry, those are weak weapons. They work for a short amount of time. They keep you from really engaging with material that's difficult for you. And finally, they become as insidious, in a way, as the other aspects of that sort of education.
Well, you were lucky in the sense that you found a teacher when you were still in high school who you really liked a lot and who took a special interest in you. And that got you interested in books and in ideas. Tell us something about the teacher and what it was about him that inspired your interest.
He was a remarkable man. He was a bohemian sort who ended up in this school simply because he wanted to try and teach. As I think back about it, Terry, the things that were most important about him was, first of all, he did not lower his expectations. He expected everybody he taught to work hard. He also believed that everybody he taught would be able to read books and write about them and talk about them in an intelligent way. He worked extremely hard. We used to think that he slept in his car and did nothing but correct papers. In fact, he lived in a little book-cluttered apartment by the Los Angeles airport. And once we got to, there was a small group of us, and once we got to feel comfortable with him and began to see him as somebody important to us, we would start even going over to his apartment, and he would sit around and talk with us about books and writing and whatnot. And I have some descriptions of that in the book that I hope, if he ever saw them, I hope he would look upon them fondly. But I think that it's really fair to say that what was remarkable about him was his expectations of us. He wanted a lot from us. He worked extremely hard to try to help us achieve those expectations of his. It seemed to me that books and language were an important way of making connections with people for him. That is, as opposed to a lot of people who are very educated, he didn't use them as a weapon. He used them rather as a means of invitation. And I think that caught us. It certainly caught me. It saved me from a very different kind of life.
Mm-hmm. Mike Rose is my guest, and he is now the associate director of the UCLA Writing Program. His special interest is in students who are most at risk. He's written a book that's part autobiography and part the story of his teaching career and his approach to teaching. It's called Lives on the Boundary, The Struggles and Achievements of America's Underprepared. Well, because of this new excitement that you found in learning and in books and writing, you ended up going to college. You went to Loyola. But when you got there, you felt you were really out of your league. This is the experience that a lot of your students have now.
That's right.
Describe what the experience was like from your perspective of being in a class where you knew that you were not only lost, but you were going to remain lost.
You know, it's interesting that you make that connection between my life as a freshman in college and many of the students with whom I now work. I didn't see some of those connections, to tell you the truth, until I started to work on this book. And the connections, the resonances, the overlaps are really there. When I entered college, well, because my own high school background was so shoddy and so piecemeal, I really couldn't qualify to get into a regular four-year school. Today, I wouldn't have had a chance. But this teacher of mine, had gone to this small Catholic men's college, Loyola, and he made some phone calls and pulled some strings, and he managed to get me in as what today we would call a special action student or a special admissions student. That is, I was admitted and was on probation for a year. That was a remarkable thing in my life, but I was also very, very underprepared for it. We had had a wonderful year with him, and he gave us an overview of, you know, Western literary history, and he taught us a lot about writing and reading. But suddenly, here I was tossed in a place where I had to know social sciences, and I had to take logic courses, and even the English courses I taught were foreign to me. They were so much different from what he had offered us. It was very unsettling. And what I did, and I think what a number of students do, is you slip into a kind of somnambulance. You sleepwalk through things. It's too scary to look at head on. Somewhere in the book I say I was whistling by the academic graveyard. You try to defend yourself against all of your inadequacies, and I think you don't really admit to yourself how poorly you were doing. For me, it almost came to an end in the second semester when my grades came close to dipping below a C average, and that would have probably exited me.
What saved your college career?
Well, again, what saved my career was some spectacular teachers. The book, in a way, is a narrative of, or a narrative that includes a series of episodes about important, caring teachers, and that is certainly what happened to me again. There were four different people who, in different ways, took an interest in me, and showed me things about humanities, showed me things about reading and writing, simply made me feel more at home in this strange and alien place. It was also, you know, it must be mentioned that there was also a big class difference. This was a school for mostly middle and upper middle class Catholic males at that time. And here I was, a working class kid from South LA, and I can tell you, it was strange for me socially as well as strange for me in the classroom. And I think if these men hadn't come along, I would have not made it through college.
With the help of these special teachers, you did okay, and as a matter of fact, you were going to go on to graduate school.
Right.
But you had a fellowship, and while on that fellowship, you decided to leave and to instead join a teaching program, an urban teaching program in Los Angeles. Was it because of your admiration for the teachers who worked with you and how much they meant in your life that you wanted to teach yourself?
Oh, Terry, you flatter me. I wish I could say it had such grand design. When I look back at my educational career, it really is so herky-jerky. It is so it is such a jagged line. I did go on to graduate school, you're right. And yet, once again, it was a case of me being very unready for what I found. I graduated from this small liberal arts college, and I think I got a wonderful education. But I went from that into a very high-powered academic graduate program. And that is yet again a different story. And to be honest with you, I was not ready for it at all. The level of competition was severe. The kind of work I was required to do was so remarkably time-consuming that I didn't quite know how to handle it. And after a year of that, I withdrew from that program. I ended up entering the teacher corps, and that took me into elementary education and sort of began the career that I have now. I did that almost as a... It seemed like something that had appeal to me because it was real and it took place in the world, and I can use my knowledge to do things. But I didn't have a clear vision of why I was doing it. And in a way, I did it as much to get away from things as go toward things. It ended up being a fortuitous move. But I guess the general theme I'd like to draw from this rather speckled autobiography is that for people like me, for kids from the working class or immigrant groups, people who are not traditionally, who have not traditionally done well in school, for students like that to enter the American educational system and have any prayer of rising up through it, they're going to need a tremendous amount of help along the way. It's going to be profoundly unsettling at various junctures, and there's going to be times when they pull out or withdraw or fail. But at those points, they're going to need help and assistance to gain their bearings again. And that certainly was the case with me.
Well, now in your work as a teacher, you've been working with the kinds of students you've just described, people who need special help and who can be really overwhelmed at the new challenges that they face.
Right.
There was a time when the words disadvantaged, underachiever, were used to describe students who were really having problems in school. Now,
yes.
The words that seem to be used now are at risk, students at risk, or underprepared.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain the shift in language?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's I think that words like disadvantaged carry with them a lot of baggage that is very troubling. I mean, certainly, on one level, students like me and the kinds of students I've worked with are tremendously disadvantaged. They're disadvantaged economically. They're disadvantaged politically. And I think no one would dispute that. But what started to happen was other sorts of words got attached to disadvantaged. For example, the word culturally disadvantaged. That is a very problematic word or phrase. If you think about it, it implies that students coming from other cultures within America are coming from cultures that are impoverished or cultures that are deficient or cultures that are defective. That's tremendously insulting, and it is simply not true. And phrases like that don't set you up to see the tremendous richness of the plurality of cultures in America that these students come from. So I think that what we're constantly trying to do is to find a language that is more neutral. Underprepared seems to me to be a fairly accurate description. If we want to use words like disadvantaged, then I think we have to be sure to hit the nail on the head and say that they are economically disadvantaged, which is true, but we have to be careful about what other adjectives we put in front of the word disadvantaged. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It does. My guest is Mike Rose, and he's written a new book called Lives on the Boundary, The Struggles and Achievements of America's Underprepared. We're going to talk more about his teaching experiences after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, Mike Rose, teaches students he identifies with, students who have been underprepared, students who have been labeled marginal or intellectually deficient. Rose grew up in South L.A. in a working-class Italian family. School was a struggle for him. Now he teaches at UCLA, where he is the associate director of the UCLA Writing Program. His interest remains with students who are most at risk. When you started at UCLA, you were working in the tutorial program, and I think you're still involved with that program, yes?
I'm not closely involved with it anymore, no.
But you were for a while.
Yes, I was.
For several years. Tell us about the variety of students who you've worked with in that program.
It was a wonderful program. Well, it still is a wonderful program. There were a lot of different kinds of students that I worked with. Some were like me. Some were students who had a very checkered educational career, but had caught fire at some point and were now coming to UCLA on some sort of special admissions or special action program. But what was interesting to me, Terry, was that there were also a number, in fact, the majority of students did not have a background quite like mine. They were academic successes. They may have come from economic or cultural backgrounds like mine, but these are kids who had been stars in school. I mean, UCLA has very rigorous entrance requirements, and so they're getting the cream of Southern California's crop. These were students who were achievers. What was dramatic and sad and difficult was the fact that for the first time in their lives, they perhaps were now in real academic trouble. They were students who were having trouble in their English classes. They were students who were unfamiliar with the lecture format of so many of their introductory courses. They were students whose background in mathematics and the sciences was just not what it was for students coming from the west side of this city. So these are students who were used to success, but had gone to schools that were perhaps not as competitive because there were more strains on those schools. They came from families that had more economic demands on them, so the students had to work much more. This presented a whole different kind of problem. You know, how do you work with a student who is failing for the first time in his or her life? And this brings up, of course, not just intellectual issues, but profound emotional ones. The tutors ended up being counselors as much as tutors.
One of the things you found with your students at UCLA, the ones who were in the tutorial program,
right,
was that they weren't really experienced in critical thinking. They knew how to read, but when it came to analyzing a book, to having a critical opinion of the book, they were very insecure and unprepared.
Yes.
How do you teach critical thinking?
Oh, Terry, I think you've asked me the question that I can't answer readily. I would say that there's a lot of ways that you go about this. First of all, we have to have kinds of curricula that have critical thinking just embedded in them. Too much of what goes on in lower division education, for example, is really just the passing out of a giant body of information with the expectation that the students somehow absorb it all and offer it back. I think we would be in much better shape if less information, perhaps, was the focus and more thought was given to how you look closely at these pieces of information, at these issues. To do that, we need to spend more time getting students to talk and to write than currently is possible in university education, at least at the first year. Another way, of course, that one develops critical thinking skills is through the kind of contact that you get through in tutorials and in conferences with professors or teaching assistants or tutors. These sorts of encounters, I think, become the place where many students learn how to question the materials they read. They learn how to frame an argument in their writing. They learn how to articulate in speech what's bothering them about a particular question. And one other thing, what's important here, and what we often don't fully appreciate, is the degree to which class and cultural differences come into play.
Since the mid-70s, there's been an emphasis on back-to-basics programs in grade schools. You've seen people who've probably been through some of those programs, and I wonder if from your perspective, seeing students at the college level, how successful you think Back to Basics has been?
That's a very good and a very complex question. I think I'd want to begin by referring folks to a wonderful report called Are Students at Risk? The particulars of it escape me now, but in that report we have lots of testimony from parents and teachers who, in the words of one woman, said, they're killing our students with basics. I think the Back to Basics movement, while certainly well-intentioned and valuable in a way in that it called public attention to educational issues, was misguided. What students need is not a return to diagramming sentences and memorizing verb forms and some of the kinds of things that emerged in the more reductive forms of Back to Basics, but they need more immersion of the kind we were just talking about in reading and writing and questioning and talking and articulating opinions. The Back to Basics movement, unfortunately, ended up revivifying some very unimpressive kinds of curricula, you know, where students are filling in blanks and circling verb forms and whatnot. My own experience suggests that that has not had any particularly interesting kind of effect on the students I see. The students I see who are doing well are students who have had the experience of going through the other kinds of curricula we're talking about, those that include lots of reading and writing and talking.
You said that you think the great books approach to literature actually excludes a lot of students like yours. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Having said what I said about the value of the great books and the importance of realizing that if it's done correctly, all students can have access to this material, I think it's equally important to say that one of the difficulties with the great books movement is that it does not acknowledge the fact that these books, for many students, have served to keep them from attaining higher levels of literacy, have served to exclude them from the schools. These books, Terry, you know from your own experience, these books are often written in a language that is certainly not current and not familiar to us. They contain ideas that may be very complicated or even foreign to some of our students who come from different cultural and class backgrounds. To not admit that is, I think, a grave error. What's equally important to say is that we must admit that students can also come to powerful levels of literacy through work with books that are not part of that canon, through the great body of work in the Afro-American tradition, from the various Hispanic cultures in this country, materials from working class life, diaries and letters and whatnot that are now being collected and issued in all sorts of wonderful volumes. These as well can be the materials through which students build ever higher powers of literacy. And to deny that, to exclude that from a curriculum is, I think, a big mistake, both morally and pedagogically.
What kind of experience is most fulfilling to you as a teacher?
Oh, you know, I love the work. I love the work. I love the kind of students I work with. And writing this book made me realize something. It sounds naive to say that I didn't realize this as strikingly as before. But I think in some ways it replicates my own past. Here I am working with kids who remind me of myself in many ways. And I think there's just something tremendously exciting about watching them, too, overcome these various barriers, you know, crossing these boundaries that are so difficult for so many people to cross. That's the great reward, watching people become ever more proficient readers and writers in ways that are going to allow them choices in their lives that they would have not had before.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
My guest has been Mike Rose. He's the Associate Director of the UCLA Writing Programs and the author of the new book, Lives on the Boundary, The Struggles and Achievements of America's Underprepared, and it's published by the Free Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Science fiction and fantasy writer Ursula Le Guin has created any number of alien worlds, but the inhabitants of those distant planets have dealt with problems all too human, subjects like sexuality and the clash of cultures. Coming up, we meet Ursula Le Guin. Also, commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews two new books about education that offer two very different views on the place of literature in the classroom. And we'll be joined by jazz pianist Kenny Barron in our weekly performance spot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm. President Bush tapped Wyoming Congressman Richard Cheney to replace John Tower as his nominee for Defense Secretary. Details from NPR's Jim Engel.
President Bush, barely 24 hours after the defeat of John Tower, announced his new choice as Secretary of Defense, calling Cheney a respected man of principle.
He's a thoughtful man, a quiet man, a strong man, approaches public policy with vigor, determination and diligence.
Congressman Cheney's candidacy was championed by National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft. Scowcroft was National Security Advisor for President Ford. At the same time, Cheney was Ford's chief of staff. When Cheney's name was brought up, President Bush liked the idea. The president had talked with Cheney many times about defense and foreign policy issues in meetings with Republican leaders and liked his views. Though Cheney has less defense experience than John Tower, he does have defense interests, says one White House official, and says another aide, Cheney has no enemies. The president and his aides asked Cheney about his heart problems. He had bypass surgery last August. Cheney called his doctor, who said there is no medical reason he can't take the job. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
Former President Reagan's national security advisor testified today that Reagan was advised by his chief of staff that he could be impeached for soliciting contributions for the Nicaraguan Contras. Robert McFarland told jurors in the Iran-Contra trial today that James Baker's warning came in 1984. Details from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
McFarland testified that after he met with the Saudi Arabian ambassador and the Saudis agreed to provide millions of dollars for military aid to the Contras, then White House Chief of Staff Baker warned that that could be an impeachable offense. At the meeting were President Reagan, then Vice President Bush, and others. I can remember Mr. Baker saying that the president could be impeached for that, said McFarland, and I can remember the conclusion being that that was not true, that it was legal. McFarland testified that President Reagan never specifically instructed his subordinates to lie about the Saudi contribution to the Contras, but he said the president said he didn't want the information shared with Congress, and a decision was made not to even tell the CIA about it. On another subject, McFarland testified that President Reagan suggested once or twice himself that a private tax-exempt organization could be used to raise money for the Contras, an action that is patently illegal. It is, in fact, one of the charges against Oliver North. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
A pipe bomb destroyed a van driven by the wife of the skipper of the USS Vincennes. The Vincennes mistakenly shot down an Iranian airliner last year, killing 290 people. Ken Kramer reports that authorities suspect today's bombing was a terrorist attack.
At an afternoon news conference, the FBI had very little to say about the investigation, but obviously it is not being treated as routine.
We certainly do not rule out the potential retribution to Captain Rogers for his past command in the Navy.
But Agent Tom Hughes says there could be other reasons for the attack. He also had no comment as to the type of device used or how it was rigged to explode. The San Diego Fire Department had said earlier it was a pipe bomb. Meantime, security has been increased at all Navy bases in the San Diego area. The FBI has declined comment on threats received before the incident or anyone claiming responsibility following the explosion. For National Public Radio, I'm Ken Kramer in San Diego.
Canadian officials say 45 people survived a plane crash in Ontario today. There were 69 people aboard the Air Ontario jet when it went down in a heavily wooded area about 100 miles north of the Minnesota-Ontario border. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 9 points to close at 2,282.14. Declines led advances 7-5 on volume of 147 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 11 cents. This is National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist Kenny Barron has played for several years with the group Sphere and leads his own trio and larger groups. Last week, when Barron returned to his hometown of Philadelphia, we invited him to join us at our piano. Kenny Barron started with this song, Like Someone in Love. He said its lyrical melody made it the perfect vehicle to acknowledge one of his greatest influences, Tommy Flanagan.
I first heard Tommy when I was a student at Roosevelt Junior High School in Philadelphia. We had an art class, and the teacher used to encourage students to bring in recordings to paint by. And a friend of mine brought in a record called Collector's Items. I think the leader was either Sonny Rollins or Miles Davis. And I was fascinated by this pianist who was on this recording. And I guess what really fascinated me the most was his touch. It was very light and delicate. And he's also very, very lyrical and very fluid. And when I found out who it was, and of course I had never heard of him, I said, who is this Tommy Flanagan? Is it Irish? I later found out that he wasn't. I finally had a chance to meet him after I had moved to New York in 61. And he remains to this day a very, very strong influence on my playing. So I'm going to play this same piece that I heard in junior high school, which is actually a Dave Brubeck composition, In Your Own Sweet Way. Thank you.
Kenny Barron is featured on the latest recording by Sphere. It's called Bird Songs. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Ursula Le Guin. In their book, Alive and Writing, Interviews with American Authors, Larry McCaffrey and Cinda Gregory write, Ursula Le Guin is probably as responsible as any other living writer for changing our notions of science fiction and fantasy. Le Guin's fictions transcend genres. Typically, they're a sophisticated blend of myth, fable, political inquiry, and metaphysical parable. Her art takes us on a circular journey to the future and then back again to the world around us now, for not only is she a wonderful spinner of fantastic tales, she also makes us take note of the words and cultural assumptions with which we construct our present. Among her best-known works are The Left Hand of Darkness, The Earthsea Trilogy, and The Dispossessed. Le Guin also writes nonfiction. She's collected some of her essays, speeches, and reviews in the new book, Dancing at the Edge of the World. In one of the essays, Le Guin wrote that it took her years to realize that one reason she chose to write in such marginally respected genres as science fiction and fantasy was to be free from academic pressure. But there was another reason.
I could sell it. That was a large reason. That was actually... It's how I broke into publishing, and that is how I became a science fiction writer to begin with. And I was fantasy, I guess, before science fiction. But anyway, I could sell in that genre. They understood what I was doing.
Did you ever write for the pulps?
Well, that's what you wrote for.
Mm-hmm. No, that was really a very macho kind of medium.
It was male dominated. It wasn't particularly macho.
Mm-hmm.
Really. And they seemed to be quite ready to have women writing it and reading it by the time I got around to it.
So you didn't have
but
to
it,
use
it
a
was,
pen name?
It was very male, yes.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to use a pen name to get your story sold?
Oh, no. Oh, no. No way.
Did you feel that your concerns or that the language that you used was different from your male counterparts?
Yeah, but it's really hard to pin down exactly how. Because there are also male science fiction writers who are not particularly interested in the technical details and stuff. There's no less scientific interest. It did seem as if it wasn't just the women coming into the field. There was a whole generation that of science fiction fantasy writers that I kind of came in with. And both men and women, I would say, were more interested in people, in the human element of these stories. They kind of humanized science fiction.
One of your best-known books, Left Hand of Darkness, was in part about gender, and it took place in a world where people were androgynous. You have an essay about your thoughts on androgyny in your new book. Why did you want to write a novel in which the characters were androgynous?
Well, I wrote it in 1967, which is really when... I think when feminism was beginning to kind of come alive again, and people were asking questions like, what is the difference between men and women? how much is biological, how much is culture, and so on. All those questions. And one way to ask those questions is to, actually, my way of doing it mainly is to write a novel about it and sort of set up a situation in which women turn into men, turn into women, monthly, as it were, and see what happens.
Would you describe the system that you created, the sexual system, the sexual traits that people have?
These people are, most of the time, are actually neuter. They are not sexually active. And once a month, you, as they call it, go into kemmer. At that point, you become either a man or a woman. You are physiologically gendered, and you take on sexuality. Your sexual drive becomes very intense. And if you're with somebody who is already going to kemmer as the other sex, you're likely to be the other sex. They trigger the opposites, but not always. So the point is that you can be the father of a child 1 month and then get pregnant the next, which would make certain changes in society.
You have an essay about books and babies that was also excerpted in the New York Times Book Review recently.
Yeah.
And this is about what you think has been the refusal of our society to grant women both the right to be creative and to have children at the same time. Women seem to feel, well, society seems to have thought that women had to make a choice, one or the other. And you think that many feminists have felt that way, too, that you had to make the choice and that the choice would be for work over children.
Yeah, right.
Now, in your life, you've had both. You have three children?
Yes.
Is that right?
And I don't know how many books. I think something like 25 books. As I say somewhere, thank goodness it wasn't the other way around. Yes, which, in a sense, gives me not only the possibility of talking about it, but I feel a certain obligation to sort of speak up and stand up and be counted as a woman who has had kids and brought them up and also done creative work. Which, particularly in the arts, there does seem to be almost a sort of an agreement that this can't be done. And as you said, it doesn't come only from the misogynist side of things. It has come from many women, many feminists. And here it gets really sticky, and I genuinely don't want to hurt people here because women are always being told you must do this and you can't do that and so on. And the fact is, creative work has replaced having a family for some women. That's fine. Having a family has replaced creative work for other women. That's fine. Then there's some of us who really need to do both and are perfectly capable of doing both. Another thing that I found kind of reading all the stuff I read to write that article is how, I'm talking particularly about writers because that's what I know most about, how women who write, who have children, their work tends to get disappeared. They're not quite respectable. The few women who are counted part of the great canon of English literature tend to be childless and often unmarried. Apparently, I have to say, the men seem to prefer it that way.
How do you think being a mother has helped and hurt you as a writer?
That's a very large question. There is a time during one's life when, if you are responsible for the care of your kids, it is very hard to do other creative work. You have to do it around the edges, in the middle of the night, or you never can get up before your kids, so it's usually late at night. Or if you have the money, you hire some kind of babysitter or some kind of child care. It's hard. Your energies, your creative energies, are being spread thin and strained. On the other hand, you are living an extremely rich life at the same time, and this is going to enrich your work, inevitably, I think. It may not seem so at the time. But one of the points I tried to make in the article is, after all, babies don't stay babies very long, whereas writers live for decades. And you do outlive your babies.
Do you keep up reading other people's fantasy and science fiction books?
Well, I did a lot. I guess I kind of OD'd. I'm not keeping up as much lately.
What did you OD on?
Well, I guess I just read too much. I have a feeling that at present, both fantasy and science fiction as genres, as publishing genres, are a little bit locked in a kind of self-replicating groove, and that there's not as much risk-taking work or original work being done. But there's some very good writers coming up. I find, at this point, particularly some of the young women writers. But I think one reason also I'm reading less of that particular thing is I had a lot of catching up of reading women novelists and poets to do, just in general. And so the last 8-10 years, I've been kind of completing my education, because I was well-educated in literature, but it tended to be mostly literature by men. So with the help of things like the Norton Anthology and Virago and other reprint houses, I've been reading a lot of stuff by women, and it's been very, very educational.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Ursula Le Guin, her new collection of essays, Dancing at the Edge of the World, is published by Grove Press. This is Fresh Air. Stay tuned for full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Things are a little hectic there right now, so I have the rundown for you. On the day after the defeat of John Tower, President Bush has a new nominee for Secretary of Defense. He's Congressman Richard Cheney, Republican from Wyoming. We'll find out more about him. NPR's John Madison has a report that Jonas Savimbi, the head of UNITA, the movement fighting the government of Angola, is being accused of torturing and sometimes killing supporters who disagree with him. Also, Commerce Secretary Nicholas Brady is announcing a plan to help third world countries get out of their debt problems. And film critic Bob Mondello has a review of Jackknife, the new film starring Robert De Niro. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Many people believe there's a crisis in American education. Numerous books, television shows, and studies have heightened concern about students who finish school lacking basic skills and cultural literacy. There are two new books on the subject, The Vocation of a Teacher by Wayne Booth, a senior professor of English at the University of Chicago, and The Call of Stories by Robert Coles, a professor of psychiatry at Harvard. Critic Maureen Corrigan has read them both and has these thoughts.
Lately, lots of critics have been attributing the crisis in American education to the fact that students aren't reading the right books. Alan Bloom, E.D. Hirsch, and William Bennett have criticized the scattershot nature of courses where Shakespeare and Dante rub elbows with Stephen King. Great teaching and a great society, they argue, can't thrive without the great books. Wayne Booth agrees. In his book, The Vocation of a Teacher, Booth claims that freshman English is the most important course in the college curriculum. It's our last chance, he says, to grab business and science majors and inoculate them with a dose of Shakespeare and Browning. Booth faults universities for handing this course over to graduate assistants and part-time instructors, what he calls the vast army of the underpaid. I've done a stint in that army myself, and I appreciate that Booth cares about a basic course that most of his colleagues ignore. But despite his good intentions, Booth's technical approach to improving education by raising English department budgets and adding more literature requirements doesn't exactly stir the soul. In fact, The Vocation of a Teacher reads a lot like an interoffice memo. But in contrast to Booth and the rest of the great books gang, another critic, Robert Coles, insists that education depends not so much on certain texts or certain courses, but on our ability to listen to the stories of other people and all kinds of literature. Coles has written over 40 books, including the Children of Crisis series, which won a Pulitzer Prize. His latest book, The Call of Stories, draws on 3 decades' worth of his experience as a teacher and illustrates the unpredictable ways in which students take stories to heart. There's the Atlanta high school student in the early 60s who reads Pride and Prejudice and begins to recognize, in Austen's picture of 19th-century class snobbery, some of her own attitudes towards desegregation. Or there's the polio victim who reads Huck Finn and shakes himself out of a self-pity as paralyzing as his disease. I had some good talks with Huck and Jim, he tells Coles. I dreamed about them. I'd wake up and I'd know I'd just been out west, on the Mississippi. Those guys straightened me out. In this age of critical theory, which has elevated books to the status of texts, Coles isn't embarrassed to agree with this boy that books are also friends. He makes us remember what it means to literally fall in love with a story. In his own psychiatric practice, Coles learned from his mentor, the doctor and poet William Carlos Williams, to actively listen to patients' stories. Williams said, "They're all we carry with us on this trip we take. We owe it to each other to respect our stories." Coles' tolerance of other people's stories demonstrates more social generosity than the elitism of those education critics whose minds have been closed to all but a few stories. In The Call of Stories, Coles writes that any narrative that offers a storyteller's moral imagination at work can enable us to take to heart what is, really, a gift of grace. It's a profound message that all of us, especially readers and teachers, need to hear.
Maureen Corrigan contributes book reviews to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet the man who created what he modestly describes as the most wholly remarkable book in the known universe, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Douglas Adams has a new book, ominously titled The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Rand Blake, a pianist who combines jazz, classical, and international influences into what's called third stream music. And television critic David Bianculli previews Wednesday's special edition of Nightline on the problems of Vietnam veterans who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Lisa Bruton, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook, Peter Murdoch, and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.